Hello, Billy Patterson here. Nearly 30 years ago on my Castaway programs, I talked with local people about their lives. Stay tuned and listen again to the following fascinating story. Good evening and welcome to another Castaway, the program where we take a well-known person into the studio for a chat about their lives, the people who influenced them, where they grew up. We ask them if there are six pieces of music they might like to take with them to a desert island, should they be shipwrecked, which is what this program is all about, of course. I'll be asking them to choose two books apart from the Bible and one luxury that they might like to take to this hypothetical island as well. Now, if this all sounds terribly like Roy Plumley's Desert Island Disc, you're right, it's a straight copy, except that I call it Castaway. Now, first guest in this series of Castaway is a man of the cloth from a very well-known Letterkenny family who has spent most of his life in Korea, and he's Father PJ McGlinchey. Father PJ, you're very welcome to the studio.
Thanks for inviting me, Billy. Very happy to be here with you talking.
Tell me about, well, we'll get into why you're here, because obviously this is only well-known, terribly famous people like yourself who are brought in. What I want to do now is go right back to the beginning, because believe it or not, there'll be some people out there who won't know the McGlinchies. So, when and where were you born?
I was born in Rafoe, actually, 1928. And then about a couple of years later, we moved to Letterkenny. My father is a veterinary surgeon. And we moved to the town of Letterkenny. And I've been living there ever since, until I left, of course, to go abroad to South Korea.
How many in the family, PJ?
Well, we had six boys and three girls, and one died as a baby, and then my older brother, Tim, and my younger sister died later. So we have six left now in the family.
Right. Where did you come in the...
I'm right in the middle. I was four below me and four above me.
Well, who's ahead of you now? There's Tim, who's the eldest.
Tim and Bridgerry, the eldest girl, and Tim, the eldest boy, and Danny, and Joe, who's living here now.
Right.
Both him.
Oh, everybody knows Joe.
Yeah. And then
yourself.
And then Eileen and Bernard and John and Pather, who died as a baby.
Oh, I see. So, big family.
Yeah, very happy family, I must say. But, of course, when we grew up, it was in the 30s when we had this depression and we had the economic war, and the farmers in Ireland were pretty hard up. And consequently, the vets were also very hard up.
One depends on the other.
The parents had a hard time raising the... So it's a large family, but I remember it was a very happy, go-lucky childhood that I had.
Well, there was one sort of traumatic experience you had, I think. Was that what the time you were sent to Mina Cladina? What was that about?
Well, of course, in the at that time we had to get through school. It would be very useful to know Irish, the Irish language. And there was a famous teacher in Mina Cladina, Johnny McGinley, God rest him, he's dead, who had a remarkable talent for teaching, especially characters like me, who were a bit slow in the take-up. And people sent their children there from all over the county to Johnny McGinley, and I went there around about the age of 10 to learn Irish. And at that time in Mina Cladina, there was no English spoken at all, and of course I didn't know any Irish much, you know. I picked up a little bit from a Cork brothers' school in Letterkenny. Cork man teaching us, you know, Munster Irish. And I remember going down the road one the first day I was in Mina Cladina, and I met this man, and he says to me, "An why to care do he's a vale boy?" And I says, "Hey, come again? What was that?" And he says, "An why to care do he's a vale boy?" It took me, about 4 months of listening to, and then all of a sudden, about after 4 months, I was able to understand it perfectly. And that was when the penny dropped. I then remembered what he said, and I understood for the first time that he was asking me, did I see any sheep going down the road?
Is that right?
Yeah.
And you found that, like mathematics, it suddenly became clear.
Yeah. There was a great...
Well, now, you surprised me a wee bit about not knowing any Irish as a child, because your mother was an island woman, wasn't she?
Ah, yeah, but in the Rosses, the Irish language wasn't spoken in her time.
It had died out then.
Not in Rutland Island, Burton Port area.
She was from Rutland.
Yeah. They spoke English.
Did they?
At home.
Yeah. Oh, I thought they would have been Irish speakers now. No. And why did you particularly have to go off to Mina Cladid? Why didn't any of the others?
Well, the main reason that I had to go to Mina Cladid was because my brother Danny had been to Mina Cladid before me.
Oh, I see.
And as a result, Danny was much smarter than I was, and is, of course, still much smarter than I am.
You're saying all the right things.
And he got a scholarship to the college as a result of Mina Cladid, but he got it relatively easily. Johnny McGinley didn't have much trouble teaching Danny. Danny was very good at mathematics, for example. But I was very poor in mathematics, and Johnny McGinley had to go to great pains to beat it into my head. But as a result of approximately 1 year at school there, I just barely squeezed the last available scholarship to St. Union's, number 6.
Well, let me tell you something now, and it's a terrible thing to say to a man of the cloth. I don't believe one word of squeezing scholarships and being everybody else cleverer than you. Come off it, PJ. Well, listen, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll take a piece of music, because you're going to have to choose 6 to take with you. Now, have you any piece that we'd like to start off with?
Well, as I say, I squeezed into St. Union's College, and
right.
It meant in those days, amongst other things, we took part in the... The Gilbert and Sullivan operas. Father McLoone was the man that time, and a great friend of Father Tommy Doherty's, and he ran the Gilbert and Sullivan opera every year, and I was in most of them while I was in the college. I was in the chorus and so forth. I had one major part in The Yeoman of the Guard, Dame Carruthers, I remember, and I also remember that after we did this opera, the Yeoman of the Guard, and after we had finished the whole thing up in St. Pat's in Cavan, they were doing it, and the boy who was supposed to take the part of Dame Carruthers, which was my part, he suddenly lost his voice, and there was pandemonium, and they phoned up St. Eunice to send down whoever had done this part up here. So I was sent to St. Patrick Cavan, which for me was the first time I ever left Letterkenny, ever left Donegal.
Really?
And this was a major journey, and I had to be chaperoned by somebody a wise man who was much older than I. And in this case, as it turned out, it was Ray McAnally. Ray McAnally accompanied me to play this role in St. Patrick Cavan, and I discovered when I got there that the man that I was replacing was T.P. McKenna. So here's two famous Abbey Theatre
actors. Yeah.
And I was in the middle, and they went upwards, and I went nowhere.
Come on. Fair's fair. We're going to play a piece from Mikado.
Yeah, that was a very nice song in the Mikado, as far as I remember. It's a very beautiful ballad type thing. And
It's called
The Sun Whose Rays. If you could play that, it might be nice.
No problem.
observe his flame, that blessed dame of all celestial highness. Is not a trace upon her face of diffidence or shyness. She borrows light that through the night mankind may all acclaim her. And truth to tell, she lights up well, so I for one don't blame her. Pray make no mistake, we are not shy, we're very wide awake, the one in
the sun whose rays are all ablaze from the Mikado. My name's Billy Patterson. My guest is Father P.J. McGlinchey, and the programme is Castaway. P.J. McGlinchey, you have just relieved T.P. McKenna, and you have been escorted by Ray McAnally, and you made your big break in Cavan as a singer. Were you ever much of a singer, P.J.? I mean, since, did you keep it up?
When nobody's around, yeah, I would humble really? Myself. No, I never went in much for...
Did you not? Because the whole family, the whole McGlinchey family, are also music.
Ah, yeah, but I kind of, I play a bit of the piano, you know, and sing a bit, but not, I wouldn't get up in front of people to...
Too shy? Mm. Okay, how did you do then at St. Eunan's in Letterkenny?
It was tough, very strong discipline in the college at the time, and everything was in Irish. We were supposed to speak Irish, we did mathematics and through Irish, we had to translate, you know, Latin into Irish and Greek into Irish and French into Irish. We even did physics and chemistry in Irish. The textbooks were all in Irish, you know.
Yeah,
and I remember later on when I went to St. Columban Seminary in Navan, for some reason or another, the first year we also had physics there. And the first exam we got, it was all in English there, you see, and I didn't know much about it in English. And I remember one of the questions was, describe how you make a barometer.
Mm.
And I said, in my paper, I said, you take a tube of glass and you stand this tube up in its end and you do this with the tube and you do that with the tube. And I spelled it C-H-U-B-E throughout the whole paper, you see. Mm. And after the thing was over, the professor who set the thing, he called me over and he said, spell tube. And I said, C-H-U-B, and then he looked at me, and I said, oh, and it hit me, and I said, oh, T-U-B, you know, and he said, which is it?
Mm.
And I said, T-U-B, Father, and he said, that's the most appalling paper I've ever had the misfortune to have to examine in all my life. But that was because I had never done it in English before.
That's the way you spelled it in Irish. Hey? Is that right, or how do you spell tube? What is tube in Irish?
Don't tell me, no.
You forgot.
I can tell you in Korean.
Oh, no, don't tell me in Korean. That was one of my next questions. Why and when did you sort of decide to join the priesthood? Were you very young whenever you made this decision?
Yeah.
Was it foisted upon you? I sort of was expected a big family to be a priest in the family, or did you make the decision?
No. There was no foisting at all. The Columban Fathers. I belong to the Columban Fathers. We were known as the Maynooth Mission to China, and they had a man going around. They still have men going around the country, around the schools and all the different groups, you know, societies.
To talk to the boys.
Yeah, and explain what they're all about and looking for a volunteer, looking for men to join them, you see.
Mm.
So they had a very very good man called Jack Byrne. Mm. He's from Dublin. He used to come around every year, once a year.
Mm.
And he talked to all the boys, you know, and he was very... He had a great personality, and he used to talk about football and so forth. He used to invite the boys up to the room afterwards and hand out the cigarettes, of course.
Oh, really?
And this made a tremendous impression. every real human being.
Listen, Kerr, this is downright bribery to get you guys to join. Eh? Look, you're going to play football and smoke fags all your life. Yeah? None of this heavy priest stuff. Well, listen, I'll tell you what. We're going to take a little break and then I'm going to come straight back to you. Okay. Right, PJ, just before the break, we were talking about you being bribed by this Mr. Byrne. He was a Father Byrne, wasn't he?
Father Jack Byrne.
Father Jack, smoking and playing football. Is this what attracted you to the priesthood, PJ?
Well, it attracted us to him as a personality. He showed us that the priests were not, gloomy characters and all that they were very human people and they had interest in other interests in us.
Mm.
And he acted as a kind of an introduction to a very attractive form, way of life, is what he did. He told us all about the life of people in Asia. Huh? Mm. And he painted a marvelous picture of the situation there, and he was so good at this that he attracted a large number of students from Letterkenny. We had at one stage enough students attending St. Columban's Seminary in Navan to make up a soccer team. We used to have our own soccer team in the town here.
The Donegal Boys?
Yeah, and they were all Columbans.
Yeah.
And we used to play the Fathers down in Ards every summer. We'd go down there. In those days, the Ards Friars, they weren't allowed to tog out. They had to play football in their
robes.
They were allowed to put on their football boots, all right. But they had to pull this habit. They were out with their rope around the middle in the habit, and they pulled this up under the rope, and you see these old hairy legs and the football boots. And they had a field that was slopey on one side, and they knew it, of course, like the back of their hand, but we didn't know it. And they used to kick us, they used to murder us every summer, the football field.
Yeah.
When we'd arrive, there'd be, seraphic... Mm. Gentle, people, and give us a great welcome. Mm. And after the game was over, they would return to this
saintly person. <yeah. laughs>
But during the
game, lining out of you,
yeah, it was always a great occasion. We look forward to it. But we had that many students in of St. Columban's in Dalgan at that
now,
time.
Now, it's a missionary.
Yeah, it was formed during World War, or right at the end of World War One, actually, to send priests to China.
Mm.
That was the original intention. So we were formed about 1918, and we sent a lot of priests to China. And then later on, they started to send priests to Korea and Japan, the Philippines, and Burma, and very other Asian countries. So that's been our main, the Columban Fathers. That's their main objective.
That's your main objective. Yeah, and you like the part of not the strict regime of, if you like, some of the other orders or perhaps your average priest. You liked this sort of broader outlook, did you? Is this what you attracted to?
Yeah, well, the thing about if you go abroad to other countries, you get a broader vision. Anybody who goes abroad, as you know yourself,
yeah.
It's a whole new education.
It is a bit, yeah.
And it's also a different type of life from the point of view of priests. Yeah, you're in a whole different milieu.
Well, when did you make up your mind that you were going to do this? Or is this something that sort of grew and developed as you went through school?
Yeah, about my third year in St. Eunan's, I got attracted to this idea. The idea that life is something more than just looking after myself, number one.
Mm.
That... the idea of being able to be of service to other people in a manner which would benefit them in a very profitable way. And of course, that means that if you can, the best way you can help anybody is to bring them to an arrival of the truth about themselves. Truth about God, truth about reality, the higher things of life.
Mm.
That attracted me at the time. And also this Father Jack Byrne, he was presenting this group of men who were in that business, if you like. And it was a very attractive thing. Mm. So I went up there I sent a letter up and got a letter back saying, come on up, we'll talk to you anyway.
Mm.
And I went through... an interview, And the, what struck me immediately about all of these men, the whole atmosphere, was that they treated you as a sort of a responsible person. For example, in Dalgan Park, the rules, there were no such thing as deans running around watching you to see if you were keeping rules. If you broke any rules, and there weren't very many rules anyway to break, but you were supposed to be there in time for meals, for example. And you were supposed to get up at a certain time in the morning, and if you slept in or did something, were late, you were supposed to go yourself and report, you know. There was nobody, you know, sneaking around looking to catch you. And that was very attractive.
Very attractive.
The whole way of running the place, you know. It put responsibility on your shoulders from day one, which meant that when you were, I was about 17 years old at that time when I went in there the first time. And that was a tremendous boost, you know, to me and to everybody there. And it was a very happy place. I was never happier in all my life than I was in the 7 years in Dalgan Park.
7 years you were there?
Yeah.
Well, now, before that, you used to go to Wee Hops down in the Devlin and things like that.
During St. Eunan's, yeah.
That's why you were at St. Eunan's.
Yeah, in St. Eunan's we had every night. In St. Eunan's, we used to have a dance after supper.
The boys did?
Yeah, there was Jimmy was a lad with a piano accordion, very good.
Jimmy Ponsonby?
No, not Jimmy Ponsonby. Jimmy Maloney.
Right.
Jimmy died afterwards, but he was very good at the piano accordion. And that's when you know, my brother Danny was there too, and Ray McAnally and all these guys, and we used to have tremendous crack, yeah, every night after supper. No girls in the place, of course, all boys dancing. But we all learned to dance very well, you know. Of course, in those days you danced, you know, foxtrots and waltzes and all that, tangos and so forth. Yeah. And we used to have great crack. And then during the summer holidays, or we used to go to the Orphelion band, which played in the Devlin Hall. And it was a tremendous social occasion. And when I hear this tune that you're about to play, which I would ask you to play, which is Glenn Miller's In the Mood, it brings back the whole memory of that great times in St. Eunan's, and the social life of Letterkenny, of our crowd, of our student days, you know.
You went off, Father PJ, 7 years to train for your missionary work, and you enjoyed every moment of it.
We had lots of football, we had lots of debates, for example. We had marvellous debates in the English and the Irish language also, which were great crack in St. Columban. We learned philosophy, 3 years studying philosophy, which is another glorious experience, you know, to be exposed to the great minds of the centuries, you know, from way back, the pre-Christian philosophers on down the years. And then we had 4 years of theology, and this again was a tremendous revelation, because when you grow up in at home, everything is taken for granted. You don't really put much thought into religion or what it means, or it's all kind of automatic, and you know the people at home, you say the rosary because mother says, my mother used to say, all hands on their knees for the rosary, you know. And but in, when you get down to studying theology, and when you study all about not only your Catholic theologians, but your anti-Catholic theologians, your Protestant theologians, and Calvin and so forth, and not to speak of Buddha and the Hinduism and Confucianism and all the other isms. And it was a tremendous experience to be exposed to all that, you know, and it's a great broadening of the mind, you know,
Tell me, you're talking about, you describe them as being anti-Catholic. Now, is that necessarily true?
Oh, yeah, there were.
Isn't that just different?
There were those.
Or were they actively anti-Catholic?
There were many people, I'm not speaking only of the Reformation times, of course. There were people who were honestly and sincerely trying to improve on the Christian life of the day. But yeah, oh, there were anti-Catholic and anti-Christian people, of course, down through history. Yeah, not, but it's like having a bucket of cold water thrown at you in the face, to suddenly realize that your position, what you hold with great conviction, was actually questioned by somebody else, you know.
And to
go through that experience is very, it's a very maturing thing, huh? and very good for the soul, actually.
Yeah.
It strengthens your own. If you don't lose your faith in the process, it strengthens it, you know.
If you can come out the other end,
yeah,
you've got it stronger than ever.
Yeah.
So the day came anyway when you were going to be sent abroad.
Yeah, I remembered well. It was right in the middle of the Korean War. I was ordained a priest in 1951. The Korean War started in 1950, huh? And they were slaughtering one another out there. And every day the newspapers were full of the Korean War and pictures in the paper. We didn't have much television those days. But we had the radio and the newspapers and pictures of starved children and millions of refugees and the casualty figures, you know. The Americans alone lost 40,000 killed Americans in the Korean War. The Koreans lost about 2 million people killed in the Korean War. And it was a terrible, an awful place. I mean, it was a real killing ground. The Vietnam thing came later on, but I was at that stage 24 years old when I got this little letter saying you will proceed to Korea. You're appointed to Korea. Of course, in those days, our superiors didn't discuss things with us. You know, would you like to go to Korea, or what? You just got this letter.
You're going.
You went. There was a you know. So I thought, you know, when I got this, I really thought that I'd be dead within about 3 months.
Did you really?
Yeah, I thought this was it. This was the end of the trail. So I got in this boat in Cove. Then they wouldn't let us into Korea immediately because the North Koreans and the Chinese came in and they occupied the whole country except for a little corner in what they call the Pusan perimeter. And they held that, and Harry Truman ordered in the Americans. That time the UN moved into Korea. And then MacArthur later moved into Incheon, north of Seoul, and the way behind their lines, and they all hurriedly pulled back. And then we got in, our group got into the country, which brought us up to the beginning of 1953. Huh? So I got there approximately 5 months before the Korean War actually ended. Huh? So I saw quite a bit of it. But I got on this ship in Cove, and it took us 6 days across the Atlantic. And then it took 3 days on a train across to San Francisco.
Right, go ahead. I was going to stop there because you went to New York, didn't you?
Yeah.
And you took in a show when you were in New York on your way, didn't you?
No, that was San Francisco.
Oh, was it San Francisco? Yeah, I thought it was New York. Right,
no, I didn't get to a show in New York.
I'll tell you why I'm leading you into the next
record. Yeah, I know what you're at, all right. That was San Francisco.
Right.
After a long journey, we were waiting for this boat, to get on this boat to go to Korea. And the word went around that this famous character, I had never heard of him before, had his one-man show in a big, huge, big theater in San Francisco. So some of the priests, the Columbans in San Francisco, whose job it is to load guys like me on the next boat to the Far East, you see. And it's a sort of a farewell gift, you know, to put us in good form. They took us down to this show, and it turned out to be Victor Borg, one of the funniest men I ever saw or heard in all my life. And a huge theater, all by himself, for 2.5 hours. He absolutely mesmerized the crowd, and I'll always remember this guy. So if you happen to have him in your collection here...
Is there any particular track you'd like to hear?
Well, there was one he was telling us. He came from Denmark, you see, and he had to learn English. And I always thought about him after when I was trying to learn Korean, you know. And he had this marvelous routine of describing how he got himself into the use of the English language.
Oh, yes,
he was bothered by commas and semicolons and question marks and all that, which apparently they don't have in Denmark and Danish.
Phonetic punctuation.
That's the one.
Well, we're going to have a little break first, and the minute the break is over, we'll come straight back in with Victor Borga for you.
Bended phonetic punctuation. Which means that while we talk, we will integrate punctuation marks by giving them sounds so that we can underline our sentences as well when we speak as we do when we read and or write. I'll teach you the system. A period sounds like this. Here is a dash. An exclamation point is a vertical dash with a period underneath. Beautiful Eleanor sat alone, dreaming of but one thing. Two years had passed since she met Sir Henry. She could still remember the unhappy evening when her father had thrown him out. They had been sitting in the park, and Henry had said...
Well, maybe some night I'm going to play Victor Borgo for my people on Sunday night in the wee programme I do, because he's very funny. I'd forgotten how funny he was.
Oh, yeah,
so I'm in Belfast myself. Great entertainer.
Yeah.
Great entertainer. Anyway, back to San Francisco and the island of Chehu. Is that how it's pronounced?
Jeju.
Jeju.
Yeah.
Jeju.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I went actually from San Francisco to Busan, and then I spent a year, the war was on, and then I spent a year on the Korean mainland to get a bit of the language and do a bit of work as a curate in a parish in the mainland. And then I was appointed, after 1 year, to Jeju Island, yeah.
And what are they, I mean, literally, you saw, the last?
4 months, five months of the war, yeah.
And did you see any sort of horrific things?
Terrible, never forget it, yeah. Yeah, I remember I remember being in the jeep, up very close to the front line, and there was a train going by, and the train had stopped the traffic on the road. And the train was going very slowly, carrying all these American troops up to the front line, you know, and they were young guys, and I was about maybe 5 yards from the train. And of course the train had been wrecked, it was just these flatbeds, they weren't sitting in carriages, they were all sitting on the flatbed. And I could see them all going by, and the train went fairly slowly. And they were scared to death. I always remember the expression of these lads. They were only, you know, 19, 20, 21-year-old guys, young lads from America. Literally like lambs going to the slaughter, you know. That was the last big battle. They made a film about that battle afterwards. They called it Pork Chop Hill.
Oh, yes.
And there were thousands of them killed. And I saw these lads on the way up to this thing, you know. And I'll never forget that. And I'll never forget they had airfields nearby taking the wounded back down again, you know. So when you think of how the human being can behave in this manner, it's the only explanation I have, but it's diabolical. It's completely anti-human, you know. But these helicopters used to fly down to there's a base at Chuncheon, they call it. They had an airstrip, a grass strip. And they would deliver these wounded, and they were screaming. Like in the war films, you know, John Wayne and all that, you don't get the picture at all. You don't get the screams of the wounded and the smell and the flies and the delays and the despair. And it's a horrible, horrible experience.
Mm. Anyway, back to more cheerful things. When you got to Jeju, I heard that you commandeered a shipload of timber. Is that true?
Well, not quite commandeered. It was. I got there. You see, there was no church and there was no buildings. I had a rented room. You see, and by the providence of God, I suppose you could say, this ship happened to run aground.
I'll be praised.
And the funny thing was, the name of the ship was the San Mateo. It was coming back from Vietnam to Japan. It was an ammunition ship. It was carrying munitions from Japan to what was then Indochina. The French were fighting the Viet Minh, they called it, not the Viet Cong. And the radar broke down and in a stormy night, and the guy driving the thing didn't know where he was going, of course, and he ran full steam into the island right below my parish. And there he was, stuck up in the rock, a 9,000-ton ship. And he had all this dunnage lumber to keep the munitions from moving. And it was all... The ship, when it ran up on the rocks, there were about five huge holes appeared in the hull. You could drive a truck through any one of them. Of course, the ship was divided into these holes. They could close them off. So when they had got tugs then from all over the east to pull the ship. It took them a month to pull it back into the sea. The front portions where the holes were would fill up with water. And where the H-O-L-E-S were, it would fill up the whole H-O-L-D-S with water, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Like, So the captain, when he heard that I had no house or no church, or had, I was living, they were all little thatched houses in this island at the time, very primitive. No electricity, no water, no pipe water, no tarred roads and so forth. He said to me, there's a team coming out to investigate this accident, and they'll be here in 4 days' time, and whatever lumber you can get off this ship in the 4 days until the VIPs arrive, you can have. Eh? So I went to my little group. I had a little group of 25 Catholics. The total population of the parish was 25 baptized Catholics, including suckling babes. Eh?
And how many people were on the island altogether?
Oh, there were about 200,000 on the island.
Really?
Yeah,
right, go ahead. You have 25, right. No. You were a new boy. You were the first man there.
No.
Was somebody there before you?
Oh, yeah.
Was there?
Oh, yeah. There were two parishes there already, one on the north and one on the south, and I was to open up a new parish on the west.
Right.
And in that corner of the island, there was only 25 Catholics. So I told them, you know, we have this big opportunity to get this timber and, you know, let's see what we can do.
Mm.
And we had about seven or eight able-bodied young guys in the group who might be able to do some work. They went off, and the next morning at dawn, I said, let's meet at the ship at dawn, and we go out there. And here's 400 men have collected at the ship. These are local villagers. Our group had told them, you know, and they all gathered. They volunteered to work, and they worked for 3 days hauling this lumber off the ship for nothing. I hadn't been to give them.
No, that's great.
So that was my first impression of the Koreans.
That's great.
In this island. They were marvelous, marvelous. Mm. Yeah.
When you got to Jeju, they had a little party for you, was that?
Yeah, the Koreans are very good at, they like the Irish a lot, you know, especially the Irish of an older generation, maybe. They have the sort of an equivalent of the Cayley, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They get together and they sing and, you know, they have a great time with very little. And they could, you would have maybe 3 hours of singing and you wouldn't hear the same song
twice,
you know. But anyway, and of course, like, you would sing a song and when you're finished, everybody claps, and then you would call upon somebody else to sing, and that person would call upon, and this way, there wouldn't be an MC as such normally. Mm. Although sometimes they'd have an MC too. But anyway, they called upon me to sing, you see, and I had only arrived in the place and I could barely put two words of Korean together. So I sang or attempted to sing, you know, Danny Boy, you see.
Mm.
And right off the bat, they said, did you hear? They all looked at me, you know, and they said, you're only arriving in the place and already you know a Korean song. Danny Boy, that's our song. They have it, Ah, Mokdong, Ah. This has been translated into Korean years and years ago, and it's so popular that they all think it's a Korean song. So whenever I hear this song, I always
remind you of
my,
that wee party.
My first arrival in Jeju Island.
Very good.
Thank you.
Jeju Island. You've been there for how many years now?
38 years.
38 years. So in fact, I suppose you consider Jeju home now. Don't you?
Yeah, I've lived there longer than I have.
You have anywhere else? Yeah. And you have obviously many good friends.
Yeah, I know a lot of people there now. Yeah.
You speak Korean.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
You would need to, actually.
I don't speak English there at all. Yeah.
Really? So it's all Korean? Mm. Well, I remember in one of your visits home, you taught the Pattersons a little song called Annie Brown.
Yeah, that's right.
Do you remember
the
famous Pattersons?
Great group, I do indeed.
Great group. Ari Rang,
yeah. It's the equivalent of the Londonderry air in Korea.
It's the favourite song.
It's the traditional song.
Now, I know you, PJ McGlinchey, as a very practical Christian. You know, I don't see you at all as a particularly a man who runs around with a book under his arm. I see a man who runs around with a scythe and a hammer or whatever, doing what has to be done. Would that be a sort of a true picture?
Yeah, well, of course, in a place like Jeju Island, where the people were living in a situation something like before the famine or even during the famine in Ireland, The method that you would use to bring Christian love is naturally different to what it would be in a situation where you have a developed country now like here, where everything's so highly organized. So, there is that difference. I had to concentrate on people who were in debt, for example, who were desperate. I started up, first thing I did was set up credit unions, which of course are very common here now, but the first credit union in Jeju, and I finished up setting up 26 credit unions, and this made an enormous difference to the whole economy of the island, which at that time was 280,000 people, you see. There were people committing suicide because of debt. They couldn't get money. There was no such thing as banks to lend money to them. And so the credit union solved all that whole problem. Then I had a problem of people leaving, as we have here, of course, leaving at home, going off to the sweatshops of the big cities and having all kinds of things happen. I had one young girl. The reason I started this was because one young girl from the parish, 16-year-old, beautiful kid, went off to Busan because her friend wrote her a letter, got a job in the factory, and 3 months later the man comes back with a little jar under his arm looking for her home and comes to the priest's house, which we had built by that stage with the timber from the ship.
Yeah.
And she tells me she has died. She fell into a tank of water in his factory, and he had her cremated, and now he's got her ashes under his arm and he wants to give this. And I was, first of all, I was shocked by this. And then I was made angry by it, because I knew she could swim. All Jeju women can swim from the time they're able to walk. Mm. So I suspected foul play. I reckon she was murdered, you know. So because of that, I got very rapidly into doing something for the young women in the place, so they wouldn't have to leave and go off to these places. So that's how that got us into the weaving business. Huh?
That's right. You brought people over from Donegal.
Yeah, we got a spinning wheel. I wrote to my father, and he sent him out a spinning wheel from Willie Thompson and Bella Buffet, and we made more of them there, and we built up quite a successful industry. We had 1,200 women. Knitting and weaving and so forth, and selling the stuff in Korea, and it gradually that also did a tremendous amount for the economy. Then we got into pigs. Pigs, of course, in Korea at that time were the pig was the family toilet disposal unit. Sewage disposal unit. Yeah, the pig was always raised in the family toilet, and it was disgusting and very dangerous, and all kinds of disease transmitted, and very uneconomic for the farmers and so forth. So I introduced the first white pig. I got a pregnant or an in-pig sow from the mainland up near Seoul. Very funny. Myself and this pig rode the train down from Seoul down to Mopo, the port. It's like going from Glasgow to London, you know. Big long journey, and caused all kinds of fun and games on the train. And then on the ship over, I had this pig in a box, a big box. A Yorkshire pig, the first time they ever saw a white pig in Jeju. Mm. And then the piglets, we distributed amongst the young men. We set up a young farmers club. And it went on from there. We built up literally a piggy bank. We eventually had 200 sows, and then we kept distributing the piglets, and went on and on and on until we had 12,000 pigs. That's the marvellous thing about the pig. They proliferate at a marvellous speed. Huh?
If I went to Jeju today, I would see an awful change from the time that you first went.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I didn't cause all the change, of course. I got... my role was to say... I could see... If you went there, and anybody coming from here would see all the possibilities. When you... Beautiful island, you know, beautiful scenery. Hundreds of thousands of acres of idle upland, you know, not being used. They had no knowledge of grass management. Like, they're very good farmers growing rice or barley or potatoes, but they're hopeless for grass. Grass is something they'd thought of as a weed, or you know, they didn't bother much about it. So I got young people from Ireland. I got Frank Evers, for example, from Trim, a young guy from who's an expert farmer, one of the top farmers in Ireland. He went out there as a volunteer, and he spent 4 years there. And he was up for a recent function here in the town. And I altogether, I got 23 young volunteers, mechanics, tractor drivers. I got a couple of vets. I got pigmen, cattlemen. I got Scotsmen, I got New Zealanders, I got Australians, and they all came at different times, and they spent their time, no salary. I provided their food and their travel expenses, which I in turn got from places like Gortha in Dublin, and Oxfam, Belfast. This is the thing I would, one of the things. When we set up our weaving factory in my place in Hallam, the people who supplied the funds to buy the machinery were Oxfam, Belfast, who were mostly good Protestants from Belfast, you see. This was, of course, back before the time of the Troubles here in the north. And I always think of this, you know, when I go into this our little factory now in Jeju and see the people, there's all this old machinery, which is marvellous machinery in the old days, you know, doesn't break down, it lasts hundreds of years.
Yeah.
And I always think of the people who supplied this, you know, from Belfast. And the whole atmosphere, of course, has changed since then. Here,
but I know that you also got the equivalent of the Asian Nobel Prize, isn't that right, PJ? Now, don't be modest on me. It was what was it called again? Mike Sisay Award. That is from the President of the Philippines.
Well, it was set up in memory of President Mike Sisay. Yeah, that's the thing. It's a foundation. They give prizes, 5 prizes every year, to people who are working in Asia. You don't have to be an Asian as such. But if you're doing something, different categories, mine was international understanding. I had promoted international understanding amongst Koreans and various foreigners, and I had got various organizations. I was kind of a catalyst. And for that, they have a special, one of the categories, the prize that Mike Sisay give. They also give a prize for journalism and so forth.
President of Korea presented you with this prize himself, didn't
no,
he?
No, I went to the Philippines, and the Mike Sisay Award Committee, it's like the
oh, it's like the Nobel people.
Yeah.
You've got to go there.
Yeah, no, it's a big ceremony, and they give you, the main thing is they give you a check. At that time it was not as big as the Nobel thing, but it was $10,000. This was 1975, they have upped it now to $30,000. Which was very useful for the work that I was trying to do there, all right. That also helped to publicize the work on the island, and it made it easier to get funds from people like Gortha and Miseria of Germany, and a few Oxfam in England, Oxfam in Belfast.
That was a great award. It was it was recognition for a lifetime's work, and I'm quite sure it was very well deserved, PJ.
Well, of course.
You can be modest about it. I'm quite sure it was.
It was for international understanding, which I went there representing a whole group of, as I say, we had 23 people mostly from Ireland here, young people who went out there, and also hundreds and hundreds of other people. See, in the whole operation involves at least 2,500 people are involved in the overall projects, various projects, you know. We set up, this Isidore Development Association is a thing for setting up small rural industries in places where nobody would, you know, think of investing money. So we have, over the years, we've set up, you know, a feed mill, and we have now a modern feed plant there, and we have this weaving factory, and we have a cheese factory and a milk factory, and we have a hospital, and we have all kinds of schools and little places tucked away in the mountains to help all the various. Then we have organized cooperatives. We have a pig cooperative, and we have a dairy cooperative, and we have credit union cooperatives and so forth. And
well, I happen to know now that it's mostly because of you. So there you are. I'm going to leave it at that, because you see, what has happened here once again.
We have two pieces of music left. We're not going to be able... I'll mention that you wanted to hear a little bit of the last movement of Beethoven's chorale. Do you remember the island we were going to send you to? Well, we won't be hearing that. But we will play you, at the end of the programme, the last little bit of Mr. Pavarotti, which you also wanted to hear, because, you know, we're doing a lot of talking.
Pavarotti, yeah, Pavarotti is a marvellous singer. He always impresses me with the he puts his whole soul into the thing, you know. That's what, it's like anybody doing anything well, anybody, a good carpenter, or a good vet, a good radio interviewer, or a good musician, or a good...
They put their all into it.
Huh? Yes. And this to me is the glory. They're giving glory to God. This is how you give glory to God, by you have your talents, the God-given talents, and you give it your all. And this Pavarotti to me epitomizes and incarnates that whole concept. And it's just watching him, as we watched him there recently, when he sings, he almost goes into ecstasy.
And this is sort of a trance. Yeah. Now, before we hear that, you're stuck on an island here. Right? Now, it's a silly question to ask you. You've spent most of your life on an island.
That's a big island,
and I'm quite sure that you could fend for yourself. But if I was to tell you that apart from the Bible, there are two books which you can take with you, what would your choice be? Well, this desert island. You're on your own, remember.
Yeah. I would like to have books which would entertain me and which would also challenge me. The book that would entertain me would be Charles Dickens, hopefully a book that would contain the whole nine yards, as they say, of Charles Dickens.
Yeah, well, we can arrange.
And that would be entertainment, or that would be, you know. But the book that would challenge me, which always challenges me, is, believe it or believe it not, it might sound a bit pretentious, but I've been reading him again, is St. Thomas Aquinas, the Summa Theologica, this man's brain, the logic, the clarity of thought, they're absolutely, I mean, as a human being thinking, a thinking man, a thinking person, to me he's the epitome, is the ideal, and he stimulates, you know. I mean, he presents, his whole way of writing is to present why the proposition is wrong, this thing is wrong, this can't be right, and the reasons it can't be right, the blah, blah, blah. And then he attacks that. He doesn't attack anything. He's a very gentle soul. But he applies the logic of the human mind, and he is a genius, capital G.
That would stimulate you.
Well, it would keep you occupied trying to keep up with him. You see?
And one luxury.
Well, my brother Bernard keeps sending me videotapes of programs from here, and that is my present luxury on this island. And if I were on another island, I can't think of a better one. Of course, there would be no electricity, but by that time we would have worked out
solar panels. Yeah, we can arrange it all right. That'll be no problem. Yeah, we'll do that. Father PJ, I didn't even ask you what the PJ was. I presume it's Patrick James, not Patrick Joseph.
No,
there you go.
No.
Thank you very much for being my guest.
It's been a pleasure, Billy. Thank you for asking me here.